This episode of the Memory Palace is brought to you by Progressive, home of the Name Your Price tool. You say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. It's easy to start a quote. Visit Progressive.com to get started. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. This is the Memory Palace. I'm Nate DiMeo. You should never turn your back in the sea. The waves, despite certain patterns and proclivities dependent on topography and geography and atmospheric conditions, are unpredictable. Their size and behavior can shift abruptly with little to no warning. If you are knocked down by a wave, the advice for anyone, from the novice to the strongest of swimmers, is to remain calm, to hold your breath, to allow the water to take you where it will, and to wait until there is a lull between waves. Then rise up to draw a breath and reorient yourself, and prepare for another wave. That was the job, on the Outer Banks, this string of islands and breakwaters that run for almost 200 miles, just off the coast of North Carolina, where Orville and Wilbur Wright first took flight, where tourists flock each summer, and mansions rise with seemingly little regard for the hurricanes that will batter them, and the rising seas which will someday sweep them away. But they were wild ones. Before bridges and berms and federal programs to restore the dunes and fix those dunes in place, keep the winds and waves from reshaping the land with each storm and squall like it used to, when hurricanes would come with no warning and sweep whole islands away in an evening, or a rip current would create a channel that would turn one island into two, and where hard people lived hard lives, people who knew not to turn their back on the sea, like Richard Etheridge. When he came to settle in the Outer Banks in the winter of 1867, it was a homecoming. He had been born there, born a slave some 25 years before. And so many of his earliest memories of life among the dunes were of the waves and the winds, and how they could change your world in an instant. He was 4 when his first hurricane came and destroyed homes and warehouses just up the beach. And wind first brought down walls, and floodwaters brought those walls, and floorboards and bureaus, white dresses floating past his house, and created a river that split the island on which he lived in half, and taught him not to turn his back in the sea. He learned about the waves, how to stay calm when one knocked you off your feet, learned about the way the bubbles in the sand meant there were clams down there. The lives of slaves were different on the Outer Banks than they were on the mainland. Out there, there wasn't much to plant or to pick or to sell, so they were put to the tasks of life in the dunes, sailing and rowing, repairing, clam digging and fishing, racing out to ships that wrecked upon the sandbars to salvage what they could. But Richard Etheridge's life was different than that of the other slaves in his own household. The man who owned him would take him aside each night to teach him to read. This was rare and illegal. And some historians speculate that they did it because Richard was his son, but any real evidence was washed away long ago. But the fact of it set the course of Richard's life. When the Civil War broke out and the Union seized the Outer Banks, Richard was there. And when other slaves escaped from the mainland to freedom, by boats they'd stolen, by rafts they'd lashed together, by their own breath and muscle, swimming in the cold and the dark across the wide sound. And the Union general in charge of the occupied territory of the Outer Banks decided to turn some of these refugees into soldiers. Richard Etheridge enlisted. He guarded Confederate prisoners. He made raids into Virginia and the Carolina coast. He fought in the Battle of New Market Heights. There is no record of what his role was in that fight, though there is record of his promotion to sergeant just 2 days later. And there is another record that remains of his time in the military. It is a letter that he wrote, that he was able to write, that he was brave enough to write, sent to his superiors on behalf of his fellow black soldiers and their families living on Roanoke Island, outlining the harassment they were suffering at the hands of the white soldiers and demanding the ouster of their commander. After the war ended, his unit was folded into what would become known as the Buffalo Soldiers, the African-American unit sent out to assist the federal government in the taming of the West. His was sent to Texas to secure the road from El Paso to San Antonio and keep down Native American revolts, all while word was coming from back east about the continued discrimination and abuse that the loved ones and friends of the Buffalo Soldiers were still suffering in the newly liberated South. He waited out his time until the waves passed over, got his discharge, and went back home. back to the Outer Banks, to the marsh reeds and the broken trees, ghosts of forests that had once shaded and swayed until they were snapped by some unremembered storm and swept away save for the black and cracked trunks that would appear and vanish with the shifting sands. And the shipwrecks, the shattered hulls through which the ocean would rush and foam. The old ships, rotting in the surf, timbers curving out of the sand like the bones of a whale. They call the waters off the Outer Banks the graveyard of the Atlantic. The warm jet stream collides with Arctic currents, which makes unpredictable tides, a breeding ground for storms, and sandbars that shift and swell unseen beneath the roiling rise and fall of the sea. More than 5,000 vessels have been wrecked there since they started counting about 500 years ago. Those are just the ones we know about. Like the Monitor, the Ironclad, which sank there in a storm during the Civil War. Blackbeard the Pirate, his flagship ran aground off North Carolina. Theodosia Burr was lost at sea along with the ship that bore her. And the wrecks became a part of the landscape and part of life for people who live there. And the misfortune of those at sea was the profit of those on land. But the waters just offshore were too vital to American commerce. The currents were too fast, the journey too tempting to just let so many ships founder or run aground and let so much cargo float away, so many people die. So a network of stations was established in a string that ran along the length of the coast. It was run by the United States Life Saving Service, which would eventually become the Coast Guard. They needed men. They would all be men then, who knew the Outer Banks, knew how the currents could shift just like that, knew the particular smell, brine and seaweed and rain-soaked wood, that came before the worst of the winds. Men who knew how to handle an oar and a sail, and handled themselves when a wave knocked them down. Richard Etheridge was one of those men, and he joined the life-saving service, first at Bodie Island as a member of what they called a checkerboard crew. Checkerboard because it had both black and white men. And, yeah. And that sort of thing didn't stop there. The men chosen for the teams were largely picked because they could do the job. They were strong and brave and skilled and deeply knowledgeable. But the African-American ones, men who had won their freedom a decade before, they were never allowed to rise in the ranks, even as they were treated as equals in the water, where the strongest swimmers would be sent first into the breakers, and the man who knew how best to read the currents would steer the boat pulled by the strongest rowers. But after the rescue, it was the black men who cooked and cleaned and did the laundry, and there was no chance of leading the station. Those jobs were political appointments, and the men who led the island outposts often ruled like local potentates and grew comfortable and soft while the men beneath them were anything but. For several months each year, from the beginning of hurricane season in the late summer, through the cold of winter and the wet of early spring, the lifesavers worked 6 days a week, training every day, swimming drills, running, building their strength and endurance, their tolerance for cold, learning how to push the rowboats up and over the surf without getting swamped or flipped, learning to right them when they did. All while waves crashed and roiled around them, they learned how to launch the rope from a gun on shore to the deck of the stranded ship to make a lifeline, which they would use to heft people back to the sand and safety. And then they would go back to the station house to seal the boats and braid the ropes to feed the men, the horses that hauled them and their equipment to the beach, did it every day. And every night there were the patrols, the overnight shifts, when each was sent to walk the beach alone, through rain and fog and sleet and whipping wind, biting cold, never turning their back on the sea, looking out in the dark. It was always dark. A torch or a lantern could make a captain lost in the rain or fog or sleet or whipping wind think they were being called to shore, to safe harbor, and could accidentally lead them to their doom. It was a difficult job. You trained and you waited, and then you sprang into action, into danger, risking their lives so that others could live. That's the kind of thing that gets put on plaques and made into mottos and repeated by rote at induction ceremonies and memorials. But the repetition doesn't make it any less true. Richard Etheridge dove into the sea again and again. Saved men and women and children and ships and the things they carried more times than we know. But there was a night in 1879 when a ship signaled offshore, and there were people who needed saving, and Etheridge's commander refused to send his men out, refused to let them do their job, and people died. And this was just one of a number of botched rescues and mistakes and failures by the life-saving service. There were articles throughout the country about the maritime disasters plaguing the Outer Banks, about 188 lives lost in 2 months. And the government sent an inspector to figure out what was going wrong and figure out what to do. And he found what Richard Etheridge had seen firsthand for years. Cronyism, incompetence, racism, men in charge who shouldn't be in charge, who couldn't be trusted. And the inspector was faced with a dilemma. These men had to go. But who could replace them? Who knew the Outer Banks and the tides and how to survive the waves? He asked up and down the banks, who was the best of the surfmen? He kept hearing one name. He wrote to his superiors to recommend that Richard Etheridge be placed in charge of a crew. He was told that was impossible. It was actually illegal. No black man, a decade and a half after the Civil War, was allowed to be the boss of a white man in the employ of the United States government. So instead, Richard Etheridge was named the keeper of the Pea Island life-saving station, leading the only all-black crew of surfmen. And they went to work. For the next 20 years, Richard Etheridge led that station. His record was unblemished, because he knew it had to be. He knew there would always be people waiting for the first crack, the first misstep, so they could step in and take it away from him, away from all of them. Those men at the station on that island at the edge of the Atlantic, working hard day in and day out, helping each other so they could help those in need, learning each day to remain calm when the wave crashes over you, to draw your breath and get ready for the next one. 20 years of early mornings, of drills and sprints, of cracked hands, ice in their beards, of cold water that took the wind right out of them, of storms that left the landscape utterly changed overnight, to be changed again when the next one came. There were rescues that lasted for hours and hours, swimming out through the punishing seas to drag a man to shore, and then out again through the whipping spray and into the water again until all were accounted for. There were nights when they couldn't save everyone. There were times when they would fight the Atlantic and reach the sinking ship, and a rope would come down through the darkness and they'd climb, and the men on board would look at them in disbelief that a black man had come to save them, that a black man could do what they'd just watched as their only hope, push fearlessly on as the sea pushed them down and pushed them down. And this man just kept coming, stayed calm, and kept swimming. There was a night Richard Etheridge heard his station had been burnt down. Someone was jealous he'd been appointed, this black man instead of some white man. But this was just another wave. He helped rebuild the station, so it was ready for the next season. There was the night Richard Etheridge died at the age of 58 in his bed at the station he kept for 2 decades. And there were all the nights when the sea was calm, and a man would walk the beach alone, looking out to the horizon, and the air was cool and quiet and smelled of grass and salt, and the night would sprawl out in every direction, and it would seem like he could just reach into the stars, grab them in his hand, and the other surfmen were back at the station, were talking and laughing and telling tales on their own island, in bodies that seemed like they could do anything back then, knowing they had to seize these moments between the waves when the sea was calm.
Thank you.
This episode of the Memory Palace is written by me, Nate DeMeo, in June of 2021. The show gets research assistance from Eliza McGraw. This show is a proud member of Radiotopia, a network of independently owned and operated podcasts from PRX. And if you are listening to this, when it first comes out in June of 2021, we are currently in the middle of our annual fundraiser. And if you want to help this show remain strong, then you can make a donation at radiotopia.fm/donate. And this, of course, will be true even if you are listening to this at some other time. There is never a bad time to help out the people who make things you care about. If you want to follow me on Twitter or Facebook, you can do so at The Memory Palace. And if you ever want to drop me a line, always happy to hear from people. You can go to nate@thememorypalace.us. I'll talk to you again.
Radiotopia.